Day one.
All right, everyone, let's get started. This is, again, you see on the board up here, our class is on narrative bioethics. I'm going to pass out the syllabus in a second, which will tell you the most important thing you need to know. Well, maybe. That's me. But you can just call me Lance. It's Lance Wheeler, so you can call me Lance. I'm going to start with a little bit of an introduction of myself and just to give you a little bit of a roadmap of what we're going to do today. A little introduction of myself, talk about the syllabus. I want to talk to you a bit about the history of medicine, or put another way, the history of the reading of the history of medicine, because this class is about the act of being the agent of and the responsibility of being a reader of medical culture and medical history. So I want to talk a little bit about that. Then what I'm going to have us do is look at some literary examples of actual narratives. Some of them contemporary, some of them historical, but I wanted to give us all just a kind of sample of the kind of reading we're going to be doing this semester, but also the stakes with which comes with this kind of reading. Hopefully what you'll find is that the reading we do in this class is very much about not just the stories we're privileged to have access to, but the job almost, the responsibility we have to not just bear witness to those stories, but to process them and to in some way give them the agency, the power with which they're meant to have, which is to say, without an audience, without a reader, they don't seem to have the purpose they're supposed to have. So what we do in this room and how we read is absolutely charged, if you will, with a kind of responsibility. So to promise you the first thing I said I'd talk about, I'm just going to introduce myself really briefly. And actually, I think in introducing me, my background a bit, and why I got to this place and what I study, it might actually inform you kind of what makes this particular discipline, because there's a reason why narrative and bioethics or medicine as related to literature is pretty personal to me. I did my undergraduate degree and my first master's at Johns Hopkins, and when I was there I was a pre-med student and loved studying medicine, and also decided to study the history of medicine as well, which is to say the culture of medicine as much as the practice and the existence of it meant as much to me. What happened was that I also ended up becoming an English major, and what I found was that for me, there were many moments where I was studying medical historical things, such as, I'll give you an example, I'd be looking at a 17th century anatomy text, and the medical student in me would look at the text and be like, it's really interesting, the ligature in this particular piece, or something, the tendons, how much they knew. Then I would find myself suddenly discovering that what interested me wasn't just the content of that image, but it was the entire thing itself, which is to say how it was created, how it was recorded, how we understand it today as a document to some degree. So what happened was that I went into being a student thinking I wanted to be a clinician, and what I found was my interest was actually a little bit more meta, if you will, was trying to think about what does it mean to think about clinicians and the history of clinicians and medical practice and patients as well. After my time at Hopkins, I bandied about working at different places. I did a Fulbright in Norway studying medieval literature. Eventually I made my way to London where I studied at the Wellcome Center for History of Medicine and did another graduate degree in the History of Science and Medicine before making my way here to Penn where I did my PhD in English studying history of medicine and literature combined. It's kind of a winding story, but I tell you that in the sense that my interests have very much been about this very oscillation between thinking about medical history, medical practice, and literary studies. And in fact, I sort of bandied about getting lots of degrees because I couldn't decide what I wanted to do, right? And what I found out was if I liked this, and I liked this, and I liked this, where they intersected just a little bit in the middle, that's what I like to do. And this class is that intersection, to be honest with you. So it's about this idea that everyone in here should probably be coming from a disparate or a different background. But everybody should be coming from one place of expertise. Either you're an avid reader, or you are a literature major, or you are a clinician, or you are somebody that loves history, or you are somebody that's a good listener or reader. And whatever skill you bring to the table, the great thing is that the point of the class is that we all sort of converge in the middle and find that very sort of like overlap, which is really what this discipline is about. Disparate voices, different perspectives, but in some way coming together. And that coming together, that fellowship happens through reading and is only made possible by these narratives themselves. I'm going to hold off on a second before we all introduce each other and first just pass out the syllabus. So that's 2, 4, 6, 8, 9. Does anybody have any questions so far? Okay, a lot to ask. So that's enough. There you are. Do we have any extras, any chance? Yeah.
Good.
Just like a follow on. All right, so we're going to go through the syllabus in just a second. Looking through each of the details, I'd like to start first by just looking at the first page, just so we've got everything clear about the where, what, and when of the class. Again, the syllabus starts at the top of the page with saying who the hell I am. And if you need to find me, you know, you can email me, and my office is just across the hall. I have an office here in the Center for Bioethics. Incidentally, I should have mentioned, too, I'm a fellow here in the Center for Bioethics, but I'm also a faculty member in the Department of English, the Department of History of Medicine, and also the Cinema Studies Department. So the various places I teach, what have you, you can still find me here. This is my home base, but all of those overlaps are also what inform this class as well, too. The time and location, you're here, so I assume you've got that figured out, both of those. Tuesdays, 4:30 to 6:45. Like I said, 6:45 is there just as a 6:30 is what we're shooting for, but if we go a few minutes extra, that's fine. If anybody has to leave early for some reason, you know, they got to pick up kids or they got to get home or what have you, that's okay. Just stealthily sort of sneak out the side. That's totally fine. I don't mind. And then this is the classroom that we're in, 321. So the course description, a lot of you have probably already read this in registering or shopping around for the class, what have you, but I'd like to read it again out loud in class. And part of that just is so that it's a kickoff for the semester. We all get to hear it together at the same time, at the same place, at the same speed. But I think also there's something about us all sort of registering aloud sort of what the mission statement kind of is for the class to some degree. So I'm going to read it out loud and be patient. So here we go. What is it like to live with a chronic, debilitating, or fatal illness? What does it mean to treat a sick person as a doctor, nurse, or other medical professional? And how does it feel to be a caregiver, witness, or outside party in such circumstances? All of these questions will inform the central query of this course: how do personal narratives inform, explain, or complicate our understandings of the medical world? In recent decades, medical humanities scholars and bioethicists have striven to include the perspectives of multiple persons in the history and storytelling of medicine. Moreover, leading medical, nursing, and public health schools have incorporated narrative studies as a part of the training of their future doctors, nurses, and clinicians. While such strategies have been innovative at the level of revamping scholastic curriculums, they are hardly new in medical history. From the case study to the medical history to the talking cure, storytelling has been a central component in the diagnostic, therapeutic, and pastoral strategies of medical cosmologies for centuries. As a transhistorical study of medical storytelling, this course will be concerned with the power of narratives to bring coherence and meaning to the lives of sick persons and medical professionals at moments of great physical and emotional crisis. Accordingly, this course will consider a range of historical and contemporary topics which speak to the bioethical dilemmas of telling, reading, disseminating, and interpreting medically relevant narratives. I'm going to read the last part of that sentence again, since I want you to think about those various responsibilities that come with narratives. Narratives aren't just stories on a page, but I want to read it again. Speak to the bioethical dilemmas of telling, reading, disseminating, and interpreting medically relevant narratives. While we will largely focus on non-fictional accounts, memoirs, medical records, journals, and testimonials, we will also consider how fictional literary sources, stories, poetry, films, and works of art explore and affect matters related to the topic of narrative and bioethics. Any questions about that?
Cosmology.
Cosmology is a worldview. So how one sees the heaven and the earth, the life and the afterlife, but also the humanity around us too. Yep. Okay, so a couple more details here. First thing here is listed the course text. Everything we read for this class, barring two things, will be available on Blackboard. So don't feel like you have to go buy books. It's advantageous if you either print the Blackboard readings before class, and you can know there's free printing just right here across the other side of the room. There's printers. Or bring your laptop, your iPad, or whatever the hell, right? It's nice when everybody has a copy of it in front of them that they can follow along, because this class is very much about read before class, absolutely. But most importantly, bring a copy, because I'm an English guy, which means let's get in there. Let's look at it. Let's read the passage. Let's close read. Let's look very closely. So recounting the story means holding it and looking at it very, very closely. So bear that in mind. Having said that, there's two books that are for purchase for the class that we're reading at the end of the semester, so there's no rush in acquiring them. The first is Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking, which is an account of her loss of family members and also having to deal with illness in her family in a very intense sort of one-year period. And then we'll also be reading William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. Both of these books are available for purchase from the Penn Book Center. Do you guys know where that is? On 34th Street, kind of near 34th and
Moravian, I guess it is, or Walnut, right?
Walnut.
I just put the order in like this week, so they might not be there today. But like I said, we're not reading them till like November or December. So if you want to get a hard copy there, you can. Otherwise, feel free to acquire your own wherever else you like. And I'm not partial to whatever edition you want. Get whatever you like. The Didion is a new enough book that I think it's going to be vintage or nothing. You know, I don't think it's, but certainly Faulkner's book, you could get a Norton or a Penguin or whatever the hell you want. I don't care. So those are the two books to buy. The final paper listed here, I'm not going to read it, but basically it's this idea that everyone has to do a final writing assignment for this class. Roughly 15 pages, but that's plus or minus, so I'm not going to balk at 12, you know, whatever you want to do. The point is I will give a couple of potential topics. If you're not wise on coming up with your own topic or that's not your thing, in November I'll give out, here's three or four ideas if you want to write about. Otherwise, sky is the limit. Write about whatever you like in those 15 pages. As it says here, the work can be involve research or close reading or be ethnographic, or it can be creative as well, too. So really, my point to you then is this semester, as we're reading and talking, in the back of your mind, tuck away a reading that speaks to you, or a kind of text, or a genre, or something that really speaks to you, and how you'd like to put that into prose. 90% of the work we do in here is what we do in person, when we talk. It's what we do when we read alone or together. So how we articulate what we're reading and what the responsibilities are of that reading. The assignment, the final paper for me is just, can you render that into prose on the page in some way? So don't think of it as a huge monumental task, but rather as a great way for you to both enjoy and to sort of give evidence to all of the thoughts and sort of feelings that you've had this semester in the readings we've done. So keep that in mind. Any questions about that? The paper or the readings? Okay, I'm not going to read the plagiarism policy because you can read. And by the way, I cut and pasted that from the website, so I appreciate the irony. And before we go through the schedule, this is what I'd like us all to sort of introduce ourselves. The schedule is, which is to say, the breakdown of the syllabus, and there's a very strategic way with which I want to approach the subject of narrative and bioethics. Before we get to that, I'd like us to go around and introduce ourselves. Pay attention, but I don't expect anybody to remember anybody's name from this exercise. You know how they do this, because don't worry, I won't either. But the important thing for me, then, is the introduction at the level of saying who we are, introducing ourselves to some degree, because this is really just the beginning of a semester-long conversation that we're going to be having. And I think it's good to say either what brought you to this class, what interested you in this class, or just where you're coming from. So, for example, I'm Bridget, I'm a nursing student, I'm interested in reading, and I was interested in this class because of blah, 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 something like that. My point is that we get to know Bridget better, right? But then also, we all pay attention to the variety of different places and perspectives with which contribute to this community of readers, I think, to some degree. So I will kick it off, and then we'll go this way. I'm Lance. I told you about what I study. I love reading. I'm an English person, but also historian of medicine, and my interest in narrative and bioethics is the fact that, for me, I'm interested in medical culture, absolutely, but for me, it's with how do we read to gain access to that culture.
I'm Christina Bach. I'm a Taurus. Uh-huh. This I was last week. No, I still am. I'm a clinical social worker at the Presbyterian Cancer Center. I took the class because I hear stories all day from my patients and my family members, and they are also starting to come into my personal life with friends of mine who are currently diagnosed with cancer. And so I'm hearing a lot of the personal, the professional, the intersection of the two. And I've wanted to write about my experiences as a social worker for many years and thought, these stories are so rich and so full of amazing things, and these patients are just fantastic, and I'm so privileged that they let me into their lives at a time of struggle. So that's what drew me to it.
Absolutely fantastic.
Hi, I'm Christine. I'm a third year law student, and my graduate degree with the MBE. I took the class because it seems nice to be able to take class on personal narratives rather than law case books, which aren't very interesting.
Great, thanks.
Erwin Noodleman. I just retired after 47 years in the practice of urology. Some of my friends here have been courses have heard this, heard why, but I chose not to be a Romeo, and I'm not talking about Romeo and Juliet, but retired old men eating out. And I'm here to learn something about the literary aspect of medicine and the history of medicine.
I'm Dan. I'm an attorney by trade. Actually, a couple years ago, had a horrible chronic pain issue that was misdiagnosed for about a year, and finally was diagnosed and treated, and so I was very interested by this course. And it's actually why I'm taking up this in this program.
Yeah.
So I was very interested in this course.
Great.
I'm Mary Walton. I'm a nurse. I work as a nurse ethicist at at HUP, and I have my MBE. And I'm really, I love reading. I love history, and I really hope to use this in working with physicians and nurses and staff around their ethical issues in terms of using stories to help tap into what's going on with the struggles and the challenges.
Thanks.
I'm Emily. I'm a graduate student in the chemistry department, and I've taken this to just kind of stretch my brain in a different way rather than just journals all the time.
I'm Julia. I have a journalism background. I worked at ABC News for a while with a medical producer. And I got a degree in nursing, so a bachelor's in nursing. I'm in the pediatric nurse practitioner program here at Penn. And I felt a little lost when I haven't been in touch with my writing roots and my journalism roots, so this is what drew me to the course.
Great.
Oh, I'm Dallas Smith. I am also in the pediatric nurse practitioner program. I did an English minor undergrad, and kind of had the same idea where I really liked English, didn't know what I was going to do with it, liked science, and it seems like a happy family marriage blend.
Great.
Jim, about 15 years as an advanced practice nurse and reconstructive orthopedic surgery. About 3 years ago, I decided to make a little bit of a change and pursue my clinical research doctorate at Drexel, focus on ethical issues at the end of life. Mm-hmm. And I certainly believe that personal narratives are what really give the flavor to patient care. So I'm looking forward to it.
Great.
I'm Carrie.
My
first undergraduate degree was actually in piano performance, and then I went back into nursing. And I'm currently in the pediatric acute chronic program here at Penn and also the master of bioethics program. I'm drawn to this course for a number of reasons. I'm actually a neonatal nurse. I've been so for about 5.5 years and also a patient with a very complex chronic health problems myself. So sort of this blend of always feeling like the person gets lost in some of the medicine is sort of a drawing.
Great.
Hi, my name is Tara. I am in the acute care chronic nurse practitioner program with Gary. My first degree, I got in biological psychology, and I managed restaurants for a while with that, as you do. And but then I went back.
Good one.
Then I went back and became a nurse, and I was nurse for about 9 years, working in as a floor nurse and then also a critical care nurse. And my exposure with that is I worked in the I've always worked in pediatrics, but in the pediatric cardiac population, which is a population where your ethics are challenged pretty much daily,
yeah.
hourly. And so it's always been something that I've struggled with and gone back and forth with and wanted to kind of delve into and kind of get straight in my own head so that I can offer offer to my patients in the practice in a more concise and aware manner. And so I really was hoping to do more in the bioethics program altogether, like get a dual major, but finances and time doesn't permit for that, so I just decided to take this as one of my electives this semester.
Great.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Heather. I'm at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia IRB. I've been there for about 7 years. I'm very interested in pediatrics, and I find that I mostly work with clinicians, so I'm really interested in hearing more of the patient perspective on that, and I'm also hoping maybe to read something about research as well. I have a big interest in research, so just generally interested in the topic as a whole.
Great.
Hi everyone, I'm Sarah. I'm from Canada.
That's all right.
Say
so
no more.
I'm in the program, the MBE program. This is my final semester here. And I'm interested in the course because I like stories, storytelling, and the history of medicine.
Great.
My name is Ian, and I'm a fourth-year student in the medical school at Temple, as well as finishing up my MBE here. My undergraduate background is in philosophy, actually, and I'm here in hopes of becoming a better physician.
Terrific.
My name is Tua, and I am just starting the MBE program, and I'm planning to go to medical school afterwards, and I really like reading, humanities, and bioethics, so that's why I'm here.
Great.
My name is Jonathan. I'm a third-year law student at Penn and also in the MBE program. Undergrad was originally engineering, and I guess I, you know, came here sort of get more of that narrative perspective that bioethics is known for.
Great.
I'm Doha. I'm also a third-year law student at Penn and in the MBE program. So I like history. I like health. And I really liked bioethics and sexuality, and so I'm back.
Great, thanks.
I'm Matthew. I'm an undergraduate studying political science and English at Penn. I've taken a few courses on the history of medicine with Lance, and this seemed like a logical fit.
Thanks.
I'm Andrew. I'm also from our Temple School of Pediatric Medicine, second year pediatry. And I was prior to starting podiatry school, you know, medical school. I was in, I did graduate studies in Atlanta, and it was mostly biomedicine, you know, and I did get a chance to sit in with Dr. Feister, and I really was impressed. And early this year, in the wake of the healthcare reform, I happened to go, I was in Congress actually the day healthcare reform has been signed. So I wanted to be, I was a delegate, I'm a delegate with the American Pediatric Medical Student Association. So just going to Congress and, you know, seeing the workings of Congress and the politicking, you know, I was really triggered, you know, to do something, you know, instead of just sitting down.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured, you know, this is a great program with a lot of wonderful people, you know, and I felt I'm really privileged to be sitting here right now.
Great.
Thank you for your
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Emily Kramer-Valenkoff. I work in the marketing department for Penn Medicine. I was a communications major undergrad, so I have a lot of interest in narrative at, you know, in self-expression and whatnot. And I have, I guess, just a personal and professional interest in the patient experience, particularly as it pertains to chronic illness.
Great.
I'm Jason. I'm a third-year med student here at Penn. I'm a history major at undergrad, so I'm very interested in kind of exercising the other side of my brain, and also interested in kind of writing my own narratives and also patient narratives later on. So I'm just writing. So.
Great.
I'm Beth. I'm a pediatric genetic counselor at AID Penn Hospital for Children. And I'm just hoping this class will help me be a better listener, actually.
Good.
I'm Russ. I'm a law student at Penn. I took this class because I wanted to explore something different, and also because I figured that so much what an attorney is supposed to do is listen to the stories of their clients and retell it to a jury or a judge. And so I thought this might be relevant.
Absolutely. Great.
I'm Jane. I'm in the MBE program.
Good enough.
I'm John Rolecki. I'm a third-year law student here, also in my final semester of the program, the MBE program. I took this class because in undergrad I was an English major, also a medieval and early modern studies major. I ended up working my final year a lot with the role of exploring the role of medicine in the narrative and life of 13th century holy women. I'm working with those concepts a lot back in the day, and so I figured, well, why not take a whole class at it and recapture the excitement for those two topics.
Great.
Hi, I'm Paula, and I think I'm in my last semester. I haven't decided. I was in public affairs at Penn for a lot of years, so it's a natural thing for me to, as a journalist, to be in this class. But I'm also here because Autumn said I had to be here. I couldn't miss this class because this was the greatest class.
Oh. Thank you.
I'm Edmund. I'm just starting this program. I've been a medical editor for the better part of 12 years, the last half of which has been here at Penn. In terms of interests, my mother forced me to read Lewis Thomas when I was a kid, Lives of a Cell, etc., and The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks was probably the best book I've read in the last couple of years. I just read that recently. I'm interested in all the courses in this program, but this seemed to be a really good fit.
Excellent. Great. Thanks, everybody, for sharing, a little, sharing a lot, or just more than anything, just introducing yourself in a good way. Hopefully, the exercise proved well what it's supposed to do, not just introduce ourselves to one another, but also see that there's a lot of walks of life and a lot of different investments and perspectives that are going to contribute, I think, to the, not just vitality, but I think quality, I think, of the discussions we'll have this term. Coming off that, I'm passing around here this sheet. Just put your name and email down, just so I can keep track to make sure that you're here, you're interested, you're enrolled, you're not, whatever, but just sign up for that, if you will. Let's return to the syllabus and take a closer look at really what we're going to be doing. What's our methodology, if you will, to this semester in thinking about narrative and bioethics. Now, there's a lot of places and a lot of people who teach narrative and narrative medicine and narrative bioethics, and I have a little bit of a different take on it. I think it's because of the fact that my perspectives are that I come to it being an English scholar, which is to say very much I read literature at the sake of wanting to look very closely at what's being said, not just literally, but also sort of like subliminally as well. And that I come to it as a historian of medicine, which is to say I'm very concerned with what it is to think about just the form and also the sort of the context, if you will, of where literature comes from. To that end, our semester on narrative medicine is going to be broken down into three units. If you look on the second page of the syllabus, I'll walk you through all of the weeks of the class, but in particular bearing in mind this sort of triptych of little breakdowns for the semester. Part one of our class is going to be on forms, which is to say that I'm going to be concerned a lot with the first third of this class about on the kinds of readings that qualify for narrative and bioethics, or the kind of readings that fulfill this category of medical narrative. So today we're going to have a short introduction looking at a few examples, and I'm going to tell you a bit, like I said, about the history of medicine, its relationship and inspiration for studying medical narratives. Starting next week, though, we're going to have our first unit on what's called memories and memoirs, which is to say I'm going to start with what we think of as the most obvious sort of way we think about medical narratives, which is to say somebody really providing a testimonial, if you will. This was my experience. This was what it was like to be sick. To that end, we're going to be looking at a couple of works of literature. If you notice, each week is broken down into literature and then secondarily to criticism. That criticism is to say supplementary texts by scholars, theorists, or just historians talking about how to read. The literature we'll be looking at next week will be a short poem by John Donne, and then two excerpts from two memoirs. The first is by Howard Dully, who is a man who wrote an account of what it was like for himself to have undergone a lobotomy when he was a young boy, and he writes this much later in life. And the second is a short entry from a book by Edmund White. Edmund White is probably one of the more famous gay authors in America. This is a book he wrote about different parts of his lives, and he wrote one chapter entirely about what it was like for him to have to go to see therapists for years as a boy, as a young man, and as an adult trying to cure himself. So that's a short section we're going to look at. And supplementary, we'll be looking at a couple of theoretical texts that tell us about what it means to read stories and what it is to think about the agency of the storyteller. So that's where we're going to start with the forms, memories and memoirs. Looking at the next week, there is the next week for us is going to be February 1st. In between, there's a guest lecture here at the Center for Bioethics. Alvin Ikoku, who is a literary scholar, is going to be speaking about malaria literature. Again, I have it listed as an optional sort of thing if you want to go, but I put it on there just out of interest for you. February 1st, we're going to be talking about testimonials and talking cures, which is to say we're going to start to think about the therapeutic value of storytelling. So to that end, the testimonial portion is where we're going to be reading accounts of persons who've been asked to recount a particular procedure, a particular medical experience, for the purposes of creating a kind of catharsis. So what does it mean to tell a story, not just in order to bear witness, but also to in some way effect, E-F-F-E-C-T, if you will, a kind of healing. And the motivation for that is very much going to be the psychoanalytic. Now, those of you who don't know anything about the history of psychoanalysis, it really comes from, obviously, from Jung and Freud and others, this idea that healing comes through talking. Because that talking, and this is where the foundation of modern therapy comes from, provides the ability to isolate the root of one's psychological crisis and problems, but in isolating the root of that problem, one also gets to excise or gets to heal it at the same time. It's called the talking cure in the history of medicine, and the reason about that is precisely that talking doesn't just bring us to the cure, talking is the cure. They're one and the same thing. So I want us to think about that concept in a larger sort of way. So what does it mean to think about, therefore, narrative as being a way that actually makes healing happen, doesn't just bear witness to moments of healing? The next week is case histories and case books. We'll be looking at accounts of cases that have been written about patients writing about themselves, and in particular how physicians have written up cases and reports about patients' conditions. To that end, a case history or a case book is one of the leading teaching tools that is used in the clinic, in the hospital, in the law school, in the ethical center. But what does it mean how we write those stories, and what does it mean how we read them in particular too? The largest part of our reading that week is going to be, I'm bringing in cases, case books from case histories, from medical textbooks, you name it. And we're going to look and see how they're written, and are they written fairly, accurately, too short, too long? What does it mean to think about that genre, if you will? There's a guest lecture on the 15th also. It's not related to our class, but there's a colloquium of lectures that happens every semester here at the Bioethics Center. Mm-hmm. And each week, one of the lectures takes place when one of the graduate classes is held, which is to say that at some point in the semester, every class gets canceled so that lecture series can happen. That's our week. So the 15th is a lecture you can come to if you want. If not, you got a free week. After looking at that series of readings then, part one forms, the second third of our class is going to be called about conditions. Now, this is me just choosing five conditions that I wanted us to look at. Perspectives, voices from the patients, but specific ones related to specific conditions. And what we're starting with is perhaps one of the most important, and that's disability. Largely because of the fact that in the last 15 to 20 years, there's been a huge rise in the creation of this discipline of disability studies. Now, at the very obvious and very straightforward level, that does mean people who have physical impairments, or people who have conditions, or people who are what we call handicapped at one time. But also it's about thinking about disability as any kind of condition or identity with which one is rendered liable or in some way inadequate to some degree. So as we do this second unit on conditions, I wanted us to start talking about disability studies, since it really sort of lays the groundwork for how we hear stories, how we grant agency to some stories, and how we take away power from some stories, depending upon whether we see a person as abled or disabled to some degree. So the first week, February 22nd, disability studies, we'll be looking at a couple of different memoirs and poems by persons who identify themselves as having a disability. And in particular, we're going to be looking at excerpts from a great little memoir by Terry Galloway, who wrote a book called Me, Little Deaf Queer. And she's a famous sort of lesbian artist, activist, deaf person. She's got a lot of things to tick off there. March 1st, we're going to be looking at cancer as a condition. And I start with cancer at that moment in large part because it provides for many of us the foundation and the framework with which we understand a whole host of other illnesses. Cancer is at once the condition that we're most intimidated by, but it's also the one that we sometimes use the template for which we think about either a worst case scenario or a normal case scenario for how to think about illness. So we'll be looking at a couple of different memoirs again here about cancer. There's no class on March 8th because of spring break. March 15th, we'll be looking at selections related to HIV and AIDS. I'm interested in that condition in particular because of the newness of it, because of the fact that what we're talking about here is an illness and a condition with a very short history of medicine, if you will. So how we choose to render it into narrative, how we choose to tell stories about it, is so charged because of the fact that it's not supplemented by a long history that comes before it. So what happens then is that we're writing the history of it and the contemporary culture of it almost simultaneously. So HIV and AIDS becomes a very important thing, and because of the fact that it's very existence and our understanding of it changes at light speed from year to year. The mere fact that 15 years ago it did not have the rate of chronicity that it has now is a testament to that fact. So how we choose to understand that condition, I think, is a great touchstone, if you will, for others. And then March 22nd, we're going to be talking about mental health. That class actually is going to be held the day after, which is to say that it's an optional guest lecture. There's a film series that happens here at the Bioethics Center run by the Scattergoods Program on Mental Health, and I'm the guest lecturer that week. So that week I'll be lecturing on a film by Alfred Hitchcock called Marnie. I don't know if anyone has seen it, but it's about a woman who has two neuroses, frigidity and kleptomania. And so she doesn't want to be touched by men, but she can't help but steal everything they have. So I'm giving a lecture on that film. It's a great little film. March 29th, we're going to be talking about addiction. And in particular, the fact that this is another example of where storytelling, where community, and where sharing is supposed to be the healing process. To that end, we're going to be talking a lot about the culture of recovery and what it means for people to go to recovery groups, to go to AA and NA and want to share. And the biggest number of things we're going to be reading that week, we're going to be reading from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is to say it's mostly story. You know, Jane had a hard time. Her husband was at work all day, and she got bored, and blah, blah, blah. These are stories that are written up, maybe based on truth, but they are fictional. And yet those stories are supposed to provide solidarity with the person who is an alcoholic or an addict. It's supposed to provide healing. It's supposed to provide guidance. And we're going to think about what does it mean to think about a text like this or readings like that, narratives that serve that kind of function. Our last third of the class is called Perspectives. And I'm not going to go into detail on saying which is in each week, because I think you can see here, but there are four perspectives we're looking at, and they are, on April 5th, caregiving, on April 12th, doctoring, on April 19th, dying, and on April 26th, witnessing. The first three, obviously, are going to be talking about vantage points, if you will, POVs, point of views, about what it means to think about telling narratives. If we'd spent 5 weeks before looking at conditions, and in particular the voices of people who had those conditions in particular, what does it mean to be somebody who's a caregiver to one of those persons? What does it mean to be a doctor, a clinician, a nurse, or some other sort of medical professional with one of those individuals? What does it mean to speak now from a perspective of not having a condition but dying from one? And the last class we're having is about witnessing. And for that class, there's no readings assigned because we're going to come together and talk about the semester if we have any lingering readings or things to talk about, but also because I'd like to use the better part of two-thirds of that last class for us all, each of us, to share something with the group. Now, it can be personal, it cannot be personal, it can be thoughts on a reading, it can be something that you read in the news that you want to write about, but April 26th is going to be our time to step up to the plate. We have been privileged all semester to hear others' voices about illness or medicine or culture or what have you. April 26th, we all have to witness and give some sort of voice. And as I said, do not feel like you have to come in and tell the story about how you lost your grandmother or anything like that. It does not have to be. This is not, you know, confessional, you know, if you will. You can say as little or as much as you want. You can talk about an anecdote or you can talk about a reading or whatever you like. But the point is to everybody bring in some piece of prose, if you will, to share with everyone else. Any questions? I know I sort of dashed through the semester, but hopefully everyone got a sense that there's not just a range of topics, but there's a strategy, I think, for how we're looking at these topics. And in particular, I'm concerned with, I know a lot of narrative bioethics books and readers I've looked at, and I know some syllabuses that you've consulted tend to be, you know, narrative and bioethics, and then it's just like book club, you know? And that's great, totally, and in some ways our classes each week will function that way. But for me, there needed to be a trajectory, if you will, to some degree, to how each week works. And in particular, that what we're thinking about is not just how do we tell stories about the clinic or about medicine, but how do stories function in the clinic? What do they do? How do we use them? And how is it important to realizing that narrative and bioethics is a new discipline? It's like 30 years old or something. But as the course description said, the idea that narrative in medicine is 30 years old, that's bullshit. Medicine has always been concerned with how we tell stories, how we bear witness, how we give sort of a storytelling component to our own health. Our purpose this semester is to try to think about what's at stake in thinking about that kind of logic. Any questions?
I missed about January the 18th. I'm sorry when this started. Basically today.
Today.
So do we catch up on this?
Do we
between now and next week? That's all I need to.
For the readings?
Yeah.
I'm going to hand them out.
Oh, okay.
Yep, because we're going to talk about them in class right now, totally. We're going to read them cold. You got it. All right. To that end, let's do that. Let's start. Let's look at a piece of literature. I think that's good enough. That should be enough. Good idea. Mm-hmm.
Okay, has everybody got a copy?
Great. So what we're going to do is for right now is I want us to look at the first poem that I passed out. Then I'm going to take a little break and talk a bit about medical history before we come back to these works of writing. The first poem we have here is a sonnet by John Milton. Everybody, if you're not familiar with John Milton, of course, is probably the most famous of 17th century British poets, most famous for Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. Very famous also because of the fact that he was writing at a time of great tumultuous political strife. In England, of course, the English Civil War and the real tensions between Protestants and Catholics persisted into the 17th century here. And Milton very much writing from a perspective of great pessimism, I think, if you will, given the strife that surrounds him, but also of great charge because he knows that he's writing at a time of great historical significance. So it's this feeling of why have I been born and put into this really shitty time in history? At the same time, how lucky I am to have been born and put in this shitty time in history, right? It's perfect for a writer. The other thing about Milton we need to know, and the thing that sometimes gets forgotten, thanks so much. Did everybody get to sign this? The yellow? Perfect. Is that if you didn't know, Milton had a major problem major health problem in his life, which is to say in midlife, he started to go blind. And by the time he was in probably his 40s, he was almost completely blind, which is to say that he went on to live, you know, into his 70s, or 60s or 70s, I think, but he spent the second half of his life writing as a blind man, and in particular, with the help and assistance of his wife, or wives, depending on the time he was married, and his daughters, who would basically transcribe for him what he would say to them. So some of the greatest works of literature he wrote, ironically, he wrote without pen to page, you know, he wrote, or quill, or whatever they all used, with the assistance of caregivers, family members, if you will. This is a sonnet that he wrote on the verge of, or at the moment of, feeling like his blindness was impending, looming, if you will, to some degree. The two dates at the bottom are the bottom left, and when we anthologize poetry, we tend to put the date of composition at the left and the date of publication on the right. 1652 question mark means just that. He wrote in 1652, ... I think is what that means. 1673 is when we ascribe to when he first seen in print. But the point is that Milton is writing this sonnet, has composed this sonnet, at a moment when he's just on the precipice of verging into becoming a man who's going to be blind to being a man who is blind, and the intimidation that comes along with it. I'm going to read this sonnet out loud a couple of times. This first time I want to read it because I want you to think about where is he writing from, and the where I mean is what is he worried about, what moment is he at, and what kind of crisis is sort of happening for him. We'll talk about those questions, then I'm going to read it again and we'll look a bit more at the language. So as I read this out loud, just think about where is Milton coming from in this particular moment. So this is when I consider how my light is spent. When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent which is death to hide lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker, and present my true account, lest he returning chide, doth God exact day labor, light denied? I fondly ask. But patience, to prevent that murmur, soon replies, God doth not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly. Thousands at his bidding speed and post over land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. Okay, let's address some of those questions I mentioned before about where is Milton writing from. How would you describe his mood in this particular moment? Anyone? Do we have an extra copy of the readings, by the way?
Great.
Give me some adjectives. Would you say Milton is jubilant?
Melancholy.
Melancholy, excellent. Great. Anybody else?
Concerned.
Tell me more specifically, what kind of concern?
I think he's introspective. He's just worried about what's going
to
happen.
Yeah, doubtful might be a good way to put it, absolutely. Anyone else?
Questioning any guilt.
What's that?
Evolving.
Evolving, and which is to say, but at the fork in the path, the fork is in the road. Which way do I go? Absolutely. Sir?
Is he expressing any guilt?
Guilt, absolutely. And I think the guilt is connected in many ways towards the responsibility he feels he has. Yes?
I have a maybe silly question.
Sure.
So when he wrote a poem, did he like say, okay, now I'm going to write a poem? Or would it just like come to him and he would write it? Because I feel like to know what he was thinking, you'd have to kind of know like what frame of mind he was in to write a poem.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean...
I guess I'm trying to figure out your question. Sorry.
No, did he just like write poems? Or did he like... think about them as he wrote them, or did it just come to him? Did he plan, like, today I'm going to write a poem, and this is what I'm going to write?
Milton was a prolific writer. That I can tell you for certain, that he wrote daily and within the day quite regularly. So to that end, one can assume that his writing was both in practice and in rumination, as you're asking. Now, whether it came from divine inspiration or whether it came from a strategic sort of plotting, I don't know.
So he could have written, like, 5 poems the day he wrote this one.
He could have. Yeah, I know. And in many ways, your question is a good one in the sense that it could inform how we understand this poem. But at the same time, it might actually distract us from what this poem needs to say, which is to say we could know all the biographical details in the world about how he wrote this poem. But the truth of the matter is this poem has to speak for itself. I'll give you an example, and this is a great lesson to think about in literature, too. A lot of people, when they take a literature class, they might read, I don't know, let's say The Tempest by Shakespeare, right? And they may read a passage, and someone might interpret what's happening in the scene, and then someone might go, that's not what Shakespeare meant. That's not what he intended. You know, how can we say that? And the response to that would be one, either, you're right. Shakespeare might not have intended that. And the second response would be, pardon my French, fuck you, who cares, right? You know, that what Shakespeare intended is not the end of the life of this particular work. The point of literature is the fact that a person writes it, disseminates it, and puts it into the world, and then it's up for interpretation. The power is with the author and the composition, but then the power comes to us as we read it. This is really the stakes of narratives as well for the bioethics, which is to say, we may think when we read a story about a person who's suffering from cancer, that when we read it, we're giving all the power in the world to the person who wrote that cancer narrative, right? Yeah, we are giving them some because we're validating that experience. But what we're also really doing is empowering ourselves because we get to read it and we get to interpret it. Now, it doesn't mean we can interpret it any way we want. This is the point. The point is the proof has to be in the pudding. If I want to know what Milton says and I want to say, Milton is actually saying this, even if he doesn't know that he's saying it, then show me. Well, if you look here at what he says here and then what he says there, it seems to me that we could read blah, blah, blah. So the agency, the power of interpretation, is really sort of the gift that we have coming to this. So thinking about Milton, what he's writing here, I think we know enough biographically to know that he's blind, his blindness is impending, and the fact that his worry is rather severe. And now it's been put into poetry here, if you will, to some degree. So we've mentioned some of the emotions he's had, right? That he's intimidated, that he's worried, that he's cautious. And then, Erwin, you mentioned the fact that he feels guilty, and I think that guilt is absolutely connected to the fact that he feels like this blindness isn't just going to be, oh, woe is me, I'm going to be blind, but now it's going to make me not be able to write poetry, and I feel guilty because that was what I thought my gift was. That's what I thought my purpose was, which is to say that Milton is writing this poem in many ways from a perspective of not just fear of the blindness, but fear, if you will, to some degree, of the inability to contribute to some degree, to serve. So what we have here then is a testimonial to some degree about disability that's coming on, but also the effects of that disability. Now, one of my things I love about this poem also, the fact is that this is about an illness, this is about a condition or a disability that's coming to him. But it's coming to him, as you see here in line two, ere half my days, which is to say, half my days meaning what, roughly? He's middle-aged. Which is to say, this poem is about blindness, but actually, it's just your typical midlife crisis poem, is what this is, right? This is a man reaching the midpoint in his life and trying to decide, am I a failure or am I a success? The midlife crisis is predicated on the fact that supposedly, and it's usually men they say this about, right? Divorce your wife, get a Corvette, and get a blonde, right? Some shit like that, right? But the whole idea is supposed to be that, oh, wait, crap, I've only got half of my days to go, I better get cracking, either having fun or being productive. And in Milton's case, well, fun, I'm going to be blind, and then great, productive, I'm going to be blind, right? So the intimidation here is at the midlife, this idea that he's cared. So what we have here is not this, and there's almost a homonym, if you will, in the title or the first line of this poem. When I consider how my light is spent, and when I consider how my life is spent. It's really sort of what's hovering over this piece. So as much as it seems to be a piece about blindness, it really is a piece about mortality. And the spent of light is very important then, because it's absolutely supposed to be a reference towards a way in which this blindness feels like the lights are being turned out, if you will, on his life. He's going to have to live the rest of his life in darkness. But it's the fear about also that bigger moment when the lights really do get turned out, which is when you die to some degree. Which is to say that that death then is a worry not just about the finality of it, but also about the way that it renders one powerless completely at the end of life. This poem strikes me as a very midlife crisis kind of poem too, I must say, because of the fact, to me, it also reads like a man who's afraid of impotence. But that impotence here isn't sexual, it's poetic, right? It's the contribution he's going to be able to make professionally. It's another reason this poem is a sort of a classic sort of midlife sort of moment, but it's one that gets more complicated and the stakes get raised because of the illness that's involved, the life that's involved, and also the career that he's made for himself. Not being able to write would be a tough thing for anyone, but for someone who had built his entire identity, his entire devotion towards God, his whole idea of how I've served my master and my maker based on writing, the inability to write becomes that much more intimidating. What I want to do is read the poem again, thinking about all of those midlife moments, the blindness, the guilt sort of thing coming on. And as I read it again, I want you to take note of this. Starting at line 7, right, we see that there's quotation marks that contain line 7. And moving down to line 9, quotation marks start again and go all the way to the end of the poem, which is to say this is supposed to be a testimonial, right? A sort of a statement. You know, Milton is making a statement here, right, about himself. Half of the poem is him quoting other people, though, which is to say, this isn't a monologue, it's a dialogue, this poem. So I want you to think about who he's talking to, and why that there is a sort of responder, if you will, to this statement he's making. So I'm going to read it again. When I consider how my light is spent, ere half my days in this dark world and wide, and that one talent which is death to hide, lodged with me useless, though my soul more bent to serve therewith my Maker, and present my true account, lest he returning chide, doth God exact day labor, light denied? I fondly ask. But patience to prevent that murmur soon replies, God doth not either man's work, not need either man's work or his own gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. His state is kingly. Thousands at his bidding speed and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait. Let's start with that first quote. Who sang that?
Milton.
Milton is saying it. We know this because it says, doth God exactly labor light denied, I fondly ask. And yet, right before the quote, it says, lest he returning chide. Who's he? It's debatable, too, so don't feel like it's certain here.
Is it God as his Maker?
It could be God. The only questionable thing there is the fact that one would think that maybe he would be capitalized. But having said that, there's no consistency at this particular time, so that's a printer's choice. But I think it's supposed to be a suggestion that maybe this is what God would say. Would God say to him, doth God exactly labor, light denied? Or even if I say it, Milton says it, he's saying it as a kind of echo of what he thinks God might say to him. Who else might be saying this line, 7? I think it could be his talent speaking to him, maybe. Anyone else? I think it's important just to realize that what it is some version of a part of Milton speaking to himself. In many ways, this is a monologue still, but it's absolutely a man who needs a voice that speaks back to him. And that's why there's literally quotes in here in this particular piece, speaking to him, responding to him. Our contemporary way to say this, or post-cyclonic, would say, my conscience spoke to me, was how we might say. And here I think Milton is finding some other place where there's an agent, a voice that's a part of him saying, doth God exact day labor light denied? And what does that mean? Line 7, by the way. It's an interesting question, because it sort of goes both ways. On the one hand, it's...
price you have to pay?
Yeah, on the one hand, it's scolding, which is to say, you know, God won't give you more than you can't stand up to, so to speak. And on the other hand, it's self-pitying, too. Does God really give us labor that has to be done during the day and then turns out the lights? In other words, it's like God is telling me, go till the land, right, and do it flawlessly. Oh, and by the way, you have to do it between midnight and 6 a.m. What, right? It's this idea that you're being called to a task that seems insurmountable because it doesn't match. Now, having said that, the challenge that's there, that's setting the bar. And it's setting the bar for what basically is the logic that finishes the rest of this poem, which is to say it's that second quote. And that second quote is said by whom? By a very specific person.
Patience.
Capital P, patience. Patience to prevent that murmur, to prevent that self-doubting, that questioning, what have you, soon replies to me. And this is what patience says. And importantly, patience, that move of having patience as a personified individual is a very almost medieval 16th century sort of like poetic move. So that if you've read much medieval literature, or if you've read much sort of very early modern literature, especially the drama, like this, the mystery cycle plays, so to speak, there's tons of plays where like a character will have in a moment, will be like, you know, I was very concerned with myself, but then charity came and spoke to me, and charity said, stand up for yourself, and that's when hope walked in, and hope told me that, well, but then I heard from vengeance and vice said, but I shut down vengeance. And the dialogue that's supposed to happen, and the way that we understand the personification of vices and virtues in this kind of mystical, religious sort of poetry, is that we should be listening to the voices of our virtues and not to the voices of our vices. So what Milton is invoking here is a very kind of canonical sense of thinking about dialogue with oneself, but made possible by these very feelings. Now, having known all that, the important thing is basically what patience says here. And what patience does is give some advice to this man who's made a living being a writer, producing narratives, at the stakes of, in the place of saying, he might not be able to write anymore. So patience consoles, and patience tells Milton, God doth not need either man's work or his gifts. Who best bear his mild yoke, they serve him best. God doesn't need your gifts. God gave you talent. But you providing poetry, you think that makes God stronger? He doesn't need that. And in many ways, there's other ways you can serve God. Bear the yoke that you're given, is what patience says. His state is kingly. In other words, that those who bear the yoke that are given by God, they are kingly. They are great. They're not pathetic. Thousands at his bidding speed and post over land and ocean without rest. And most importantly, the last line of this poem, they also serve who only stand and wait, which is to say that one can serve God, not by having to be a writer, but you can serve God in spite of losing your gifts and having been given that gift if you just bear the yoke you're given, and if you just wait. Patience is the one that says this, right? So to be patient, ironically, can be the greatest gift. And my favorite thing about this poem is that patience gives that really good advice of just standing and waiting, and Milton does not take that advice. He writes this poem, right? This is a man about who's being set up with this idea that he can't write anymore, and he's going to have to deal with the fact that he can't write anymore, and the fact that I've learned a lesson and patience has spoken to me, and I just have to be patient. And then Milton, it's like Milton went like this, that is true. What a great idea for a poem. Bridget, get in here, right? It's like dictate another poem. I don't know if it's Bridget, but the idea being that what's supposed to be the impediment, what's supposed to curtail the composition of literature for this particular moment, for this great author, his own condition, his own disability, his own illness, ironically becomes the fuel for that very thing. And what's most important about it is that Milton does this, and he doesn't just write about it. He turns it into a poem, and he turns it into a damn sonnet, no less, which is to say he highly formalizes, he highly canonizes it, and he turns it into an absolute work of literature. And to be honest with you, besides Paradise Lost, this may be one of the most famous things Milton has ever written, so to speak. It's one of the best things, too, I think he's ever written, because of the fact that it's so wry, and it's so earnest, but at the same time, it usurps its very earnestness, you know, because of the fact that it exists at all to some degree, you know? And I love that because it shows that Milton absolutely is devout towards God, and he absolutely was a religious man. But it's like he was told, I will show you that I love you, God, and I will do your work, and I will use the gifts you gave me and make them great, and you will take them away, and I will accept it. But by God, I'm going to defy you, and I'm still going to use them anyway. And the survival of the poem is a testament to that, I think, in a very large way. I mention that because I think those kinds of stakes, in terms of what we write about in a moment of illness or a moment of disability, are not that unique to Milton here. In fact, I think we're going to find this semester that the very motivations, the very trepidations, and the kind of feelings of guilt, culpability, worry, panic that Milton expresses just in these 14 lines are actually featured in probably a vast majority of the things we're going to read this semester. The gift of Milton, like the best of poets, is the fact that they do the same thing as other writers, they just do it much more economically. That's what poetry does, it condenses it all. Any questions about that? Okay, let's take a minute, pause from these. I want to turn your attention really quickly to this handout. How are we doing on time? Good. Okay, there you are. This is me giving you just a quick, there you are, rundown on what it means to think about, you're welcome. Narrative studies, and in particular how it comes from the history of medicine, and in many ways how... Okay, does there have an... Oh, can you guys do something?
Thank you.
Yep. In many ways how, narrative studies, the history of medicine, and even bioethics to some degree, owes a lot of their history towards the same kind of trajectory of thinking about what does it mean to do scholarship about the clinic that maybe is not necessarily clinical in the purest sort of sense. So it's historical, or it's ethical, or it's literary. I'm going to give you just a little bit of a rundown of the variables related to history. Everybody got one of these little handouts? Okay, let's start with the first page, where it says the history of medicine. I want to mention to you just in a little quick rundown here sort of where the history of medicine as a discipline comes from. So it really dates from the very, very late 19th century, like the last decade of the 19th century, with its huge upsurge happening at the very, very beginning of the 20th century. And who was largely doing this kind of history tended to be physicians and clinicians themselves, which is to say that in their spare time, in their free time, you know, they tended to write about, like, you know, you know, I love being a, you know, an obstetrician. And so, in fact, I love, out of curiosity, then to read the history of obstetrics. So in my spare time, I'm going to write a book about the history of obstetrics, is what a lot of physicians would do in the early 20th century. And that is good scholarship because of the fact that it shows a real passion and an investment and an interest. Unfortunately, it also showed there tended to be a lot of sort of hero worship that tended to happen in that kind of scholarship, and largely just because that the scholarship was coming from a single kind of voice rather than a multiplicity of different voices to some degree. So what we had then in sort of the very, probably the second and third decades of the early 20th century was a shift with which we start to think about doctors as historians versus historians as doctors, which is to say, thinking about doing medical historiography, and if you all know this term, is everybody familiar with the term historiography?
Nope.
It roughly means, as with any gruffy, you know, it's the study of, in this case, it's the study of history. So historiography, to some degree then, is how we do history, and in particular, who gets to do history. It's not just the stuff that's in the history textbook, but it's in particular the process that made possible that history being written. So what we had then was the history of medicine really had existed at the, by the turn of the 20th century, but the historiography of medicine, the scrutiny about how are we doing this kind of history and is it the best way, that really gets its birth probably in the 20s and 30s, largely in places like Germany and Scotland, but also in the United States, and in particular places like I list here, Yale and Johns Hopkins first, and then later at McGill, Harvard, and Penn. These are some of the first schools that really create history of medicine departments. Initially, those departments were within schools of medicine and hospitals, only to now be where they normally are, which is in schools of arts and sciences. What happens then is we need to see that, and I'll be honest with you, when that change happens, it's still largely physicians that are doing the history of medicine, but they're realizing, but to do the history of medicine, I need to rely on more than my expertise as a clinician. I need to learn how to be a historian. And knowing both of those actually makes the scholarship better. So what we have then here then by founders such as Henry Sigrist and Osei Temkin then is an attempt to study the history of medicine in a way that's more than just the clinician looking back on his profession with rose-tinted glasses. To that end, we get the creation of what happens in the middle of the 20th century, that those who study history know that this is not unique just to the history of medicine. It is indicative of all walks of history. We get the creation of what is called social history. Or which is to say, history that's considered broader and bigger than just big name things or the canonical sort of standard historical touchstones, dates, places, institutions, people, that sort of thing. To that end, the history of medicine in the first part of the 20th century, when it was done largely by clinicians and when it was largely done sort of as a side gig rather than a full-time job, tended to be about what was called the great men of science, so to speak, right? And it tended to be on great individuals, tended to be on institutions, discoveries, just major dates that had happened, so to speak, inventions. Those of you who remember taking, I don't know, AP Bio in high school or taking biology in college or some other sort of science class, you may know that in the midst of all that tome and writing about the science, there would often be like a sidebar spotlight on history of biology. And it would usually be on like Jonas Salk or the polio vaccine or Johns Hopkins University or something like that, right? That was how history of medicine was done in its entirety for a long time. Great men, great places, great institutions, right? How we refer to that history is as a top-down history. It's a history that looks at those who are empowered, whether it's the prominent physician, whether it's the great discovery, whether it's the institution. Social history is about changing that. Social history is about, I'm not saying we need to jettison the great men or the institutions or the discoveries or the dates. It's that we shouldn't probably be starting here, though, or we certainly shouldn't be stopping here, right? We need to consider the opposite end. We need to think about doing what a history that we now refer to as doing history from the bottom up, which is to say, we need to start thinking about everybody that's involved in this history of medicine, not just the people who make the sidebar in the AP Bio book, right? So what would be some other things then, do you think, that would speak to the other side of this? If we looked almost entirely at the history of medicine in the early years by looking at who was the great person, what was the great discovery, where was this institution happening, that sort of stuff, what else informs the history of medicine?
Yep. The experience of the patient.
Good, so the patients, absolutely. The first person we think of who's being overlooked. So what was it like? Instead of saying, you know, when did they discover the polio vaccine and how did that happen, we might say, wait a minute, what was it like to actually have polio then? That's kind of an interesting question as well. So patients,
These are other people as well, caregivers, other professionals, right? Which is to say there's more than just doctors, right? What else? If over here we tended to look a lot at the memoir of Jonas Salk, or the documentation that showed the founding of the Salpêtrière in Paris, and what have you, what kind of documents would we be interested in over here?
Stories.
Diaries. Newspapers. Plays. Art. Music. Right? Advertisements. Could be anything. The point of the matter is that we're concerned not with just what's happening at the Salk Institute, but we're also understanding what the world thought of the Salk Institute as well. How does the understanding of medicine become important? In other words, we're not just concerned with what's happening within the four walls of the clinic, but what's happening and how culture understands the clinic as well, too. To that degree, perhaps it's the patient that we often think of as the most important person from doing medicine from below. I have a little bit different theory. My theory that who the most important person is just the layperson, which is to say that how we understand illnesses, conditions, the clinic, professions in general are absolutely essential and central to how we understand the history of medicine. So to that degree, if we spent too long thinking about who discovered the vaccine for polio and not enough time thinking about the person who had polio, social history, I think, goes even so far as to say, you could have not had polio or not known a damn person who had it, but your opinion is just as important, too, in contributing to how we understand the history of polio to that degree. So what we're talking about then, in many ways, is a widening, if you will, to some degree. And I mention all of this because if history of medicine was about trying to understand how we understood medicine and how we understand medicine culturally, not just clinically, social history of medicine put the burden on being able to do that for a variety of different texts. And that burden meant that what had to happen was that modes of reading and studying had to change. And that's where narrative comes from. That's, for me, where the history of narrative and medical culture and clinical culture comes from. It comes from the desire to do better in terms of how we understand the clinic and, in particular, the history of the clinic. And therefore, the burden on us is to read lots of different kinds of narratives. In other words, what changes is voices that count and how many of them do. And what that creates for us then is this very sort of template that we're sort of working with here. If I can direct you towards just a couple of quotes that are listed here in this handout that I gave. On page 2, or the reverse of the first one, is a quote by Henry Sigrist, famous historian of medicine who was at Yale and Johns Hopkins, who really sort of laid the groundwork for what we think of as social history of medicine. He says here, "The social character of medicine is also the result of the fact that in all medicine actions are always two parties involved. In consulting the history of medicine, we are interested not only in the history of health and disease, of the physician's actions and thoughts, but also in the social history of the patient, of the physician, and of their relationship. What did disease mean to the individual? How did it affect his life?" Sigrist is trying to have us see that what we're talking about here is not just a one-way street, if you will, to some degree, and how we render and how we understand the lives of patients. It goes both ways, if you will, with clinicians. I'd only qualify Sigrist's claim here when he says that it involves two parties. I would say a limitless number of parties. I think Sigrist is trying to set up the fact that don't forget that if there's two people in the room, be mindful of both of them. But I think our charge is to be mindful of, don't forget everybody else that's not in the room too, because they also contribute to how we understand these stories. If you'll turn really quickly, I've just got a list here of bullet points that I drew up of how to do history from the bottom to inform us. Multiplicity of perspectives, variety of texts, greater emphasis on humane history, moving beyond his institutions, surpassing the great men of science model, and jettisoning notions like discovery. If you don't know, discovery is totally one of those terms that in history of science, medicine, technology, we totally hate. The reason, because for so long, the history of science and technology was like, when was this discovered, and when was that discovered, and when was that created, and all that sort of stuff. And the truth of the matter is, finding a moment of discovery is almost a futile task, because we may think that so-and-so invented gunpowder and blah, 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 but then we find that somebody else did. Just like in history in general, you know, we all went to elementary school and learned that Columbus discovered America at a certain date, right? And then, of course, later we all learned, there were people here already, so I don't know how he discovered it, right? Right? So discovery is one of those terms that we tend not to focus on too much. It's also because of the fact that it just casts for us the wrong kind of story. It oversimplifies the kind of story we want to tell. And the burden we have as social historians and the burden we have as narrative and medicine scholars is
we can't oversimplify. If anything, we just have to address and appreciate the fact that this story and these narratives are supposed to complicate, and that complication is a good thing. All right, if you'll turn real quick, I'm just going to run through a couple more things in this handout. Here we have Roy Porter, who's a famous historian of medicine. I studied with him when I was in London, and he does a lot on medical history from below. And he has five basic points to bear in mind when we do social history of medicine, and I just wanted to list them so that, again, you're mindful of them, and then that we're saying them out loud here. In many ways, reading the course description at the beginning, reading some of these quotes, saying out loud these lists of caveats, if you will, we're sort of putting into the ether in this room for the first day, sort of reminders and also a kind of tone to be mindful of the rest of the semester. So this is Roy Porter's five tips for doing medical history from below. We need to question medical history's preoccupying concern with cures. And I'm going to qualify what Porter said there and say that we need to be concerned with medical history's preoccupying concerns with cures and mortality. Those tend to be the two things we're most interested in. And in particular, can I erase this? Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that they are the two biggest narrative concerns. Narratively, historically, and in narrative, 9 times out of 10 at least, the story of somebody who's sick usually involves them either getting cured or dying. That is it, right? It tends to be the kind of thing. Because either that makes the most exciting story, right? He's cured, or it's so heartbreaking, he died, you know? those two stories, right? Or because of the fact that we tend to forget about chronicity and chronic illnesses. We tend to forget the fact that a lot of people have a condition and illness, and they neither die from it nor are they cured from it. They just learn to live with it. I actually think the biggest responsibility is the fact that not just the fact that we don't think those stories are as sexy as death and cure, because certainly they're not the ones that get made into Oscar-winning films, what have you, right? But I think it's also because of another shitty high school lesson we learned, which is to say about how narratives are supposed to work. Does everybody remember this from high school? Right? Right? Exposition, rising climax, conflict, resolution, right? It's what it's supposed to be, which is to say that something critical has to happen here so that you can have the resolution, so to speak. Now, with the chronic illness, this is what happens, right? And plateau, right? Now, you're going to die eventually. Everybody dies at some point, right? But the reason we're told that this is the narrative arc that we're supposed to follow is because, according to literary theory, and it's probably true, this is what engages the audience, right? They get involved, the stakes get raised, something kind of like it happens. They're allowed to catch their breath and resolution and leave, and be like, oh, that was really good. You know, that sort of thing. But this is what a chronic illness does, or an illness that doesn't lead just to death or cure, right? It goes up, it plateaus, and probably the person dies, right? Now, this is where your high school literary teacher or your playwright workshop person is going to say, well, I think you're probably apt to lose your audience somewhere in here. It just kind of levels off, you know? So what that means, then, is that the history of narratives tends to ignore the illnesses that fall into that particular trajectory. The problem is most illnesses don't immediately lead towards cure or death. They often lead towards the chronic, or they learn to lead to the living with. And with each year, with more advances in medicine, more and more things are becoming livable with. They're not necessarily going towards cure, and they're not necessarily going towards you've got 2 weeks to live. It's about management. Now the problem is, what that renders for people who are stuck in that phase, that chronic phase, is the feeling that with the old-fashioned arc, the arc that's traditional, that I'm not supposed to tell my story yet because it's not over yet, right? I'm supposed to wait until that resolution happens. Either I know I'm going to die or I'm going to be cured, so to speak. And so what happens is I'm still living my story, so I'm apt not to tell my story. What we're going to look at is a lot of narratives and a lot of historical moments where we actually are trying to defy that particular tendency on the part to say, want to have cure or death be the motivating factor. So that's our first thing to think about that Porter says. Secondly, we need to be aware that our ancestors were as concerned with wellness as with illness. This is probably the thing that breaks wide open how we understand medical culture, which is to say that we tended to focus for a long time in studying narratives and studying the history of medicine about looking at when people are sick, when people are dying to some degree. But the truth of the matter is when people are well, that's still a part of the history of medicine. I'll give you a counterexample. We tend to focus on the abnormal sometimes more than we do the normal because of the fact that we think that that's sort of where our interest sort of is drawn to. So for an example, the category and the very word itself, homosexual, existed before the category and the very word heterosexual, which is to say, in history of medicine, in history, we focused on that which was abnormal, only then to realize, well, wait a minute, what about everybody else, so to speak? It's like that with the history of medicine. We tended to focus on who is sick, who is dying, what have you, only then just pause and think, what about everybody who's not sick, so to agree? they're a part of that history and that culture too. In other words, to be a part of narratives and medicine, so to speak, does not mean that you have to be a sick to be a member of that club. Maintaining and being mindful of your own wellness means that you're a part of that history. And I say that to say that we are all a part of the discussion. Those of us in here who have been sick or who will be sick or what have you, you have no more primacy or privilege to be a part of this dialogue or community. So if you will, we all do. Sick or well, it's all part of that same sort of population, if you will, that makes up narrative culture and narrative literature. Number three, sickness cannot be seen in isolation. Number four, family medicine remains woefully neglected. And number five, we should stop seeing the doctor as the agent of primary care. Number five, in many ways, is a tack on to number two in this list, which is to say that there's a lot of debate in history of medicine and narrative medicine discussions about whether we should call sick people patients or whether we should just call them sick persons. The problem with the word patient is the fact that it tends to render the person who's ill only legitimacy once they go and see a clinician. So if I'm sick and I'm feeling terrible and I'm treating myself at home and self-medicating, but I haven't seen a doctor yet, technically I'm not a patient yet because there's no counterpart to a physician. Having said that though, all of the stuff I go through before I see a physician is still an important part of that story and that experience and that history. So us being mindful of a term like patient, we're not saying there's a caveat or a moratorium on it or anything like that. We can use that term, but just what it means to say patient. But also knowing that care and healthcare, that narrative and that history doesn't begin when the doctor enters stage left. It's already been happening. And it will happen even after the doctor or clinician exits stage right, so to speak. Let's look at the last thing that's on here. This is a quote by Georges Rousseau, who's a literary scholar, and he wrote a text on literature and medicine. This is probably from the early 80s. It's a really kind of rudimentary, but it's at the early stages of this discipline, but does set up one of the most important points, I think, to make about when we talk about narratives and bioethics and narrative medicine. It's this here. Most crucially, we must pay attention that the influence between medicine and literature can proceed from medicine to literature, but that it also proceeds from literature to medicine. Which is to say that very early in literary studies and in narrative studies, its connection to medicine was usually understood that literature was basically like a repository for what was happening in medicine. Like, what did people think about the doctor in, you know, the 19th century? Well, let's read Middlemarch by George Eliot. And what it says in there is probably a reflection of what's happened in medical culture. In other words, the literature just kind of absorbs what's happening culturally in medicine at a particular moment. And that's true. But Rousseau's point is that it goes the opposite way, too. What George Eliot wrote about the doctor characters in Middlemarch also changed the way doctors saw themselves at that particular time. To that end, what we're talking about here, and if you want to write a little word off the side here, is reciprocity. We're talking about the fact that literature does not exist as the repository, as the place to record what happens in medicine. Literature is also the thing that can change the way that medicine is done. And I'll give you a great example. We know this is true in culture because, for example, a television show, right? When a television show like ER or Grey's Anatomy or something comes on, they're almost always applauded when they first come out because they're so accurate and authentic and they really record it like it happens, right? And it's true, they do, because it goes from medicine to TV, right? They record how medicine is done. But the more that show becomes popular and disseminated, it changes how many people want to go into a different discipline, how certain practices are done, how there becomes a uniformity in how clinics are done, and how everybody wants to be a George Clooney hunky pediatric ER doctor, right? That kind of thing, right? Which is to say, suddenly now it's going from television back to medicine. It's so too in literature as well. Literature has this capacity absolutely to record how medicine is done, but literature also has the capacity to change how medicine is done as well too. And in fact, the very existence of this class is a perfect example because of the fact that we're here reading, but we're doing it in the clinic, if you will, as a part of the School of Medicine. So we're already seeing that reciprocity. Any questions? I know that was a real slapdash run through a lot of historiographical things, but I hope it gives everybody a good, you know, working tools chest, if you will, of a couple things to think about. And I give you a better sense also about the disciplines I come from and how I take narrative and bioethics a certain direction. I think we've got about, let's see here, it's almost six, so let's take about another 20 minutes and look at a couple more literary examples, and then we'll just call it a day. What I want us to do is look at a couple more narratives here. The first three we're going to look at are episodes from the Bible. When I teach literature and medicine classes, I like to use these episodes, usually because I tend to start talking about literature and medicine, looking at the 15th, 16th, and 17th century, where religion is almost impossible to divorce from how medicine is understood and stakes of life. Having said that, I want us to look at it because these are literally sort of parables, if you will, about how we've understood culturally and in the Western canon, so to speak, about what it means to be sick. Now, I'm just going to put the cat out of the bag here and put it right up front, which is to say that these illnesses are important because they set up for us two very different ways in which we have historically, religiously, but I think more largely even outside of the, pretend these aren't from the Bible, culturally, we think of illness. Illness is either the punishment, the burden that we're supposed to be put under, or whether illness is also supposed to be the character test, which is to say in some ways that we've been made ill because of the fact that we've been blessed. And of course, we're going to start with the second one, which is with our ideal person here, who is Job. Job, the most patient, dutiful man ever to walk the planet Earth. If you don't know the parable of Job, Job is the man that God isolated and identified as his most devout follower, so to speak. And in a conversation that God has with Satan, because they're shooting the shit, right? Satan says everybody will turn their back on you at some point, right? And God says, not Job. And then Satan says, I'll show you. And then God says, go ahead. You can do whatever you want to him, and I promise you he won't turn his back on me. And this is where this moment comes from. And of course, if you don't know the story, the result, of course, Job is dutiful, and he doesn't. And of course, not surprisingly, Satan loses and God wins in the Bible. So this is... Did I give away the ending? Sorry, no. No. So I want us to look at this moment where it's supposed to be the biggest trial that Job goes through. So for instance, Job loses his friends, he loses his fortune, his children abandon him, his wife turns on him, but the biggest trial that he's supposed to go through is the fact when he's rendered sick. Because that's supposed to be the ultimate thing for the devil, which is to say this is when people really will show their true colors, so to speak. So I'm going to read here Job, this is chapter 2. One day the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? Satan answered the Lord, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There was no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still persists in his integrity, although you incited me against him, to destroy him for no reason. Then Satan answered the Lord, skin for skin, all that people have they will give to save their lives. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. The Lord said to Satan, very well, he is in your power. Only spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and inflicted loathsome sores on Job from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Job took a potsherd with him to scrape himself and sat among the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as any foolish woman would speak. Shall we receive the good at the hand of God and not receive the bad? And all this, Job did not sin with his lips. So we do see Job, of course, as dutiful. Not surprisingly, his wife comes off as a cad here, right? It's still patriarchal, so. But the point is that Job absolutely, in the face of that illness, in the face of what's supposed to be the ultimate test, he absolutely stands up for himself. And I mention this episode because it's always the one that if someone gets sick, and in particular if they have a relationship with God or if they're spiritual, there is that question, am I being punished for what's happening to me, or is God really testing me because of the fact that he thinks I can go through with this, right? That he thinks I'm strong enough for this. So blessing or curse almost always hovers over how we think about these medical, these sort of clinical encounters. Now, what really interested me in this passage, though, is how it ends. And I think for the sake of our discussion, our class, it's the last sentence, for me, that is the one that really hovers the strongest. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. In other words, it's that he did not curse God. It's that he did not turn away from him. It's that he did not utter, if you will, if he did not speak. And in many ways, that he did not complain. And I mention that because the kind of devotion, the kind of saintliness, the goodness that we ascribe to Job here isn't just the fact that he didn't turn his back on God, but in particular that he didn't do it with words, that he didn't do it with his lips. And I think it's not that he didn't just say, screw you, God, I'm over this, right? But that he didn't complain. Now, why I say that is because of the fact, talking about sickness and talking about narratives that deal with illness or health, there's a fine line between when we render somebody as telling their story and when they're just bitching and moaning. And how we determine that can just be how we read it. But having said that, there's a fine line that we scribe here too, towards whether one is obligated to say something about their illness or whether one is stronger when they don't say something about that illness. And it hovers over, I think, how we read all kinds of illness narratives. Do we render that person who's ill, who tells their story, heroic because of the fact that they tell it, or because of how they tell it, or do we actually consider them more heroic when they don't tell it at all, don't sort of sin with their lips to some degree? I mention it because it's going to be different with on every text. There's no universal standard here. But I do raise it in the sense that it's something that we're going to have to check as we read these stories, how we endow or don't endow. And it goes both ways. We absolutely could read another story. By week six, you could be, oh my God, if I hear one more story about someone talking about their sickness, I'm going to scream, right? It could be that, right? Or it could be the opposite, which is we could do the same thing, but in a bad way, which is we could tend to overly romanticize all of these stories. She is so brave. She really is. And it really could be a story about somebody who is so goddamn annoying, right? But we've endowed them with so much romanticism, right? That we need to check our tendency to either blame or not a particular voice is absolute. And I think that's what this Job episode hovers from. Let's turn and look two moments from the New Testament. These are both moments of healing attached to Jesus, but they also involve a kind of telling as well. And I think that's why I like these episodes. The first is from the book of Mark, and I'm going to read it aloud. And it goes, a leper came to him begging him, and kneeling, he said to him, if you choose, you can make me clean. Moved with pity, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, I do choose, be made clean. Immediately the leprosy left him, and he was made clean. After sternly warning him, he sent him away at once, saying to him, see that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest, and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded as a testimony to them. But he went out and began to proclaim it freely, and to spread the word so that Jesus could no longer go into a town openly, but stayed out in the country, and people came to him from every quarter. When he came to Capernaum, after some days, it was reported that he was at home. So many gathered around that there was no longer room for them, not even in front of the door, and he was speaking the word to them. Then some people came, bringing to him a paralyzed man, carried by four of them. And when they could not bring him to Jesus because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him. And after having dug through it, they let down the man on which the paralytic lay. The man was the paralytic lay. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the paralytic, son, your sins are forgiven. Now some of the scribes were sitting there, questioning in their hearts, why does this fellow speak in this way? Is it blasphemy? Who can forgive sins but God alone? At once Jesus perceived in his spirit that they were discussing these questions among themselves, and he said to them, why do you raise such questions in your hearts? Which is easier, to say to the paralytic, your sins are forgiven, or to say, stand up and take your mat and walk? But so that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the paralytic, I say to you, stand up, take your mat, and go to your home. And he stood up, and immediately took the mat, and went out before all of them, so that they were all amazed and glorified God, saying, we have never seen anything like this. All right, so let's start with the episode at the very beginning, with the leper. And Jesus renders him clean. He heals him, but gives him the one warning. See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and ask what Moses had given and you shall be healed or what have you, right? So Jesus has given him a strict instruction, only one actually, right? You need to go do this, but just promise me one thing, you won't say anything to anyone. You won't tell your story, if you will, right? And of course, what does the man do? Blab, 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 right? He tells everybody. To the degree that what happens is that now word of mouth spreads, the story spreads, if you will, and what happens is that Jesus gets inundated with people and requests, if you will. Now what I love about this is that Jesus commands that the story not be told, or asks that it not be told. Now, it never hurts the man that he told it. Jesus becomes very popular, and Jesus doesn't shy away from the praise or what have you, right? It's almost as though Jesus was, like, saying to him, and I actually like this episode, because I actually do think, in sort of my reading of it, that Christ told him something more along this lines. Ready? Make sure that you just don't tell anybody about this. Especially not that big crowd over there. Especially not the lady in the big hat. She tends to blab. Although she will be here till 3:30. I'm not going to say anything else. Right? It reads a bit more like that kind of a thing. Which is to say that there's a command here not to tell the story. And yet the parable exists. And the parable as a narrative, this whole stretch of it, because the story isn't about healing the leper. The story is that the leper told his story. And all these other healings happened as a result of it. So to that degree, the request here by Christ, I almost feel like, has to have been some way a kind of planted suggestion, if you will, to some degree, right? Because what happens is that the fame and the acclaim, and in many ways, the one healing begets another and another and another, because of the fact that Christ actually is able to have his story be told and spread on. It's also why later on when the scribes are whispering and saying things about Christ, he knows that that story is being told as well, too, and challenges it and speaks to it immediately. So here we have then a kind of dissemination of healing that's not just at the level of the healing, but it's actually the story that is the agent that makes possible the future healing to some degree. Let's look at one more episode, and this is Matthew. It's a similar kind of episode, slightly different, though. This is Matthew chapter 9, verse 18. While he was saying these things to them, suddenly a leader of the synagogue came in and knelt before him, saying, "My daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and she will live." And Jesus got up and followed him with his disciples. Then suddenly a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak, for she said to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I will be made well." Jesus turned and seeing her, he said, "Take heart, daughter. Your faith has made you well." And instantly the woman was made well. When Jesus came to the leader's house and saw the flute players in the crowd making a commotion, he said, "Go away, for the girl is not dead but sleeping." And they laughed at him. But when the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took her by the hand, and the girl got up. And the report of this spread throughout that district. As Jesus went on from there, two blind men followed him, crying loudly, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." When he entered the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" They said to him, "Yes, Lord." Then he touched their eyes and said, "According to your faith, let it be done to you." And their eyes were opened. Then Jesus sternly ordered them, "See that no one knows of this." But they went away and spread the news about him throughout that district. So I like this because it's kind of three moments, right? We have here... The woman at the beginning, right, who decides to touch, and that's a sort of common cultural touchstone now, if I will but touch the cloak of his, hem of his cloak or something, I shall be healed, right? I love it, too, because it's the fact that in these eight cases, both the first and the last, the agency, if you will, of healing to some degree is in some ways with the sick person themselves. It's their faith that has made them well. Now, Jesus has given him the blessing and made it happen, but it's the people's faith in some ways that it's occurred their healing. Having said that, the way these stories are set up is really quite wonderful because, again, it's the infamy of them that really creates possible the prestige, if you will, of Jesus. Now, the first one with the woman is so great because God is walking wearing some kind of cloak, right? And she just sort of reaches and touches just the slightest tassel at the end of it or something like that, right? And we're supposed to understand that Jesus is sort of moving and floating through this thing very popular, right? Crowds have accumulated around. But so attuned is he and so aware of the faithful and the dutiful, and I guess so sensitive to his cloak, I guess, that the minute someone touches it, it's almost like, "You have faith, daughter," right? He sort of knows immediately that she's there, right? But it's good also because of the fact that what it shows is, again, a kind of communication that's tactile, I think, in this particular moment. And in many ways, the thought the woman has here, you know, she said to herself, "If I only touch his cloak, I'll be made well." It's like if this was a cartoon, it'd be one of those thought bubbles that's coming out of her. It's not words, right? But it's cloud, thought bubble, right? But Jesus can read the thought bubble is sort of the idea here, right? He knows what she's thinking is that she wants to heal herself. So her act, and by the way, her knowing where to find Jesus when he did is because of the fact that it's predicated on the fact that word has spread that he's coming to see this person here. So again, we see this storytelling, we see this dissemination of the story in some way, laying the groundwork for other kinds of healing. The girl is absolutely healed in the middle, word of that spreads, and then we get the two blind men at the end, who, as we see at the end of this episode, once again, blah, 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 run off and tell everybody, if you will, to some degree, right? It's as though God heals and also, "May you be healed," and a gossip. Go. You know, they seem to go hand in hand, right? Now, I mention that because here we have an example, unlike the Job one, where it seems that healing can't exist without gossiping, without storytelling to some degree. So I set that up to say that neither of these are universally correct, but there does seem to be a tendency on our part to want to render illnesses and narratives of illness either at the level of "that's too sacred, we shouldn't talk about it," or "I've got to tell you about this," you know, that sort of thing. And that extremity, that polarity, I think, hovers over how we read these stories, too, in many ways. And they don't have to be biblical, they don't even have to be religious to be at that stakes. I think what's inherent in that kind of tendency to want to blab or not blab is not the religiosity of these episodes, it's the illness of them, in many degrees. Because illness is often that thing that we think of as the most private thing that we only want to share with the people we know the closest, or that thing that we want to tell right off the bat. How many of you know this person? I have had many a friend who have been very sick or have a problem, and they won't tell you a damn thing about their illness. "Well, I didn't want to tell you, but about 6 months ago, I got diagnosed." 6 months ago? Why didn't you tell me, right? Very personal. And other people, "Hi, how are you?" "Well, I have this boil." And, you know, the person, right? Some people are of that ilk, right? That's the first thing they want to tell you is about their health or their illness, so to speak. And I think it shows a narrative as well, too, that kind of polarity. I'd like to end by looking at, bringing us back to the 20th century, a poem. This is a poem by Theodore Ritke. Have you guys read much Theodore Ritke or familiar with him? He's a 20th century German-American poet, very famous for writing images sort of poetry, very popular in his lifetime, particularly the middle of the 20th century, then not talked about as much, I would say, in the 60s and 70s, only to sort of be reabsorbed and reappreciated in the latter part of the 20th century. His verse is very evocative, very somber, very simple in the way it appears, but actually there's a real kind of wry cynicism that tends to be behind it quite often, even as it's very lovely and beautiful at the same time. Ritke, like I said, wrote very prolifically throughout the middle part of his life in the United States. But one of the things he struggled with was mental illness. At the time, I believe it was diagnosed as a kind of, bipolar sort of disorder, so to speak, which is to say that he was manic depressive. But to that degree, depending upon whether he was in a manic phase or depressive phase, often meant that he was in and out of institutions and underwent all different kinds of treatments, which at the time involved electroshock therapies, hydrotherapies, if you're familiar, which are water baths, douching, different kinds of water treatments, isolation therapies, rest cures, different kinds of treatments that are really supposed to help sort of temper the mind of the person who's too apt to either be manic or too apt to overly be somber, so to speak. Now, Ritke wrote a series of poems about some of institutionalizations, and this is one of the more famous ones. It's called Lines Upon Leaving a Sanitarium. Sanitarium, of course, being the term for mental health institution at the time. I want to read it out loud a couple times, as I tend to do with poetry, but this first time I read it, I want you to think about the form of this poem, which is to say that it's entirely rhyming couplets that we have here. And the fact that each couplet is its own sentence as well, too. Notice, period, period, period. I think there should be a period of the first one, too. So what we have here are independent, isolated thoughts. Having said that, though, they're strung together. They're a part of a unit, and not just because they're in this poem, but because they sort of work as a collective to some degree. So I want us to listen to them and think about what is the common sentiment of each of these particular mantras, if you will, and what does it mean that they're collected together. This is Lines Upon Leaving a Sanitarium. Self-contemplation is a curse that makes an old confusion worse. Recumbency is unrefined and leads to errors in the mind. Long gazing at the ceiling will in time induce a mental ill. The mirror tells some truth, but not enough to merit constant thought. He who himself begins to loathe grows sick in flesh and spirit both. Dissection is a virtue when it operates on other men. What's the common assessment here by Ritke? He just had to paraphrase.
Thinking too much makes you crazy.
Totally. Don't overthink it. Seems to be the thing, right? Don't overexamine. Don't overthink it. In other words, what he's had to learn in some ways is about just letting go and not being too deep, if you will. So the first one, self-contemplation is a curse that makes an old confusion worse. Absolutely. You're going to tease yourself out of thought if you continue to think too much on a problem. Recumbency is unrefined and leads to errors in the mind. Long gazing at the ceiling will in time induce a mental ill. That one we almost feel like he may have learned the hard way, right? Staring too much, right? Staring too much will absolutely make you go nuts, right? The mirror tells some truth, but not enough to merit constant thought. And I think that's supposed to be literal and metaphorical here, which is to say, staring at yourself in the mirror too long will absolutely just make you go nuts. And also, just self-reflecting too long, in a metaphorical sense, might do that as well. He who himself begins to loathe grows sick in flesh and spirit both. Self-hatred, self-scrutiny, overly criticizing yourself is not the best thing to do. And lastly, perhaps the best couplet in this whole piece is my favorite, the last one. Dissection is a virtue when it operates on other men, which is, of course, literally true, right? A physician who tried to dissect himself would be a damn fool, right? And he'd probably do a bad job of it, right? But it's also true psychologically and psychiatrically, too, right? There's a reason that therapist doesn't treat himself. So we, too, should not be apt to want to dissect ourselves, but rather seek help when we need it. You know what I mean? It's sort of the point, I think. Now, why I love this, too, is also the combination of the content of these lines versus the style with which they're written. What do you make of the style, the couplets, the rhyming? How does it change the attitude, the tone of the poem?
It's almost whimsical, kind of.
Totally. It's sing-songy, right? It's like a nursery rhyme meets, you know, an institutionalized madman's diary, you know, right? You know, so it's all these horrific thoughts, but it's like, Self-contemplation is the curse that makes an old confusion worse. Recumbency is unrefined and leads to errors in the mind, right? Mm-hmm. But it also seems to me to be a kind of mnemonic device too, right? Which is to say that the rhyming seems to speak to me to these are coined phrases that he's had to learn to some degree. These are reminders that in some way he's had to say to himself and to put them into rhyme. And now to put them into verse in some degree helps them to become memorable. It helps them to sort of be mindful of. Now, having said that, I think it also has the tendency to render them less authentic also, too. I told you Ricky is kind of a cynic, and he totally is. And the truth of the matter is, all of these sentiments here are really interesting, and as we said, they tell you things you can learn in a sanitarium. But I read this poem, and the more I read it, I think, I don't think he believes a damn one of these things, mm-hmm. you know? I think he is mouthing and parroting the things he needs to say so he can have permission to leave the sanitarium. This text actually has in common with it two of the most famous novels of the 20th century. Adolescent novels, in fact, maybe the two most famous adolescent novels. The first is The Catcher in the Rye, if you've read this, right? Holden Caulfield. And if you remember the who's read Catcher in the Rye? If you remember the premise of Catcher in the Rye, right? Holden Caulfield starts the novel where? It's been a while. No? Close, though. It's just before the school portion. It's where he actually, because it's first-person narrative, right? It actually starts when he's giving his testimonial at the Nut House, right, where he's been put up for the institution. And he basically starts, you know Holden Caulfield's voice, and he basically says this, I'm not going to tell you that whole damn story about them phonies, but if you want to know, I'll tell you about that one weekend, but I'm going to tell it quick and listen closely. Here we go. And then he goes to school and starts about leaving school and all that. But it's all about that weekend in New York. But it's him giving his testimonial upon being put into the institution. So it's him giving a testimony the day he is put into a sanitarium or put into a mental health place. But its contrast is the other most famous 20th century adolescent novel, and that's The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. That novel ends with the protagonist at the institution, and the very last episode is her speaking to her psychiatrist and to her friend at the hospital where she's staying and saying, I'm gonna miss you, I'm really scared to do this, but I know I need to do this in order to be able to get out and make on with myself. Okay, here I go. And then she opens the door and she goes into the room to give her testimony to see if she can be let out of the institution. That's where the novel ends. So, to The Catcher in the Rye starts with when you first are put into institution. The Bell Jar ends with just on the precipice before you go in and give your testimony. And Rutke's poem is the testimony itself, right? And that testimony absolutely seems to be one of all the right things to say. In fact, it sounds a little too much, you know? It's like the person who goes before the parole board, right, and says all of the exact things. I'm really sorry, I wouldn't do this, it's my fault, da 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 da. We've all seen this on, like, cable shows, too, like, people go before the parole board and they give the testimony. And sometimes they say things like, great, 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 great. Oh, you forgot this one. Sorry. Come back in 2 years, right? And other times the person may say all the right things, but the question is about the sincerity with which